Blog Talk Radio.
I heard there was a secret chord that David played, and it pleased the Lord. But you don't really care for music, do ya? Goes like this, the fourth, the fifth, the minor fall, and the major lift. The baffled king composing hallelujah, 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 hallelujah. Faith was strong, but you needed proof. You saw her bathing on the roof. Her beauty and the moonlight overthrew you. She tied you to her kitchen chair. She broke your throne and she cut your hair. And from your lips she drew.
Larson coming to you from Cosmic Citizen with our delightful guest host today, Andrea Barnes. Good morning, Andrea.
Yes, I'm here.
Welcome
and
to Cosmic
so
Citizen.
And
Paula,
and
you're
I'm
here too?
Yeah, we had some technical problems this morning, so I had to log in to the switchboard, but I'm going to leave it on, and I'll check back in. And so, callers, if you give us a call, hold on there, and I'll get you on. But I'm going to turn it over to my dear friends, Crystalline and Andrea. Have a great show, you guys.
Thank you.
And have a wonderful vacation, Paula.
Yeah.
We hope you have a great time.
Yeah, I'm going to be by the ocean, which is a real treat for a landlubber like me.
Yeah, good.
Okay, guys, love you. I'll check back in and make sure if we have callers, I'll put them through.
Thanks for helping
thanks,
out.
You bet, guys. No problem, Andrea. Okay.
I couldn't get my computer to get into the Cosmic Citizen. It just wouldn't. It'll see other websites, but it wouldn't see that one. So. made a desperate last attempt and called for.
Well, I can't tell you how many times I've had that same problem.
Really? Darn.
Yes. For some reason, Blog Talk Radio loves Paula.
Right.
And recognizes her running the show, but isn't always receptive to others of us who try to act in her stead. But we all love Paula.
Oh,
so
yeah.
It's not hard to understand. Anyway, you know, we're continuing today with a series on the different religions of the world and asking our listeners to call in and share their personal religious experience. Last week, we had two wonderful guest callers, Imam Ibrahim Kazaruni from Colorado, who started our program for the first hour, and then Hamid, who called in for the second half and shared his personal experience, both in Islam as well as with the Urantia book. Today we're going to focus on another of the Abrahamic traditions with the religion of Judaism, and we've asked some of our callers to call in and share their, or our listeners, excuse me, to call in and share their personal experiences. And the motivation for this series is a quote from paper 103 in the Urantia book. And I'll read that quote again. While your religion is a matter of personal experience, it is most important that you should be exposed to the knowledge of a vast number of other religious experiences, the diverse interpretations of other and diverse mortals, to the end that you may prevent your religious life from becoming egocentric, circumscribed, selfish, and unsocial. So to that end, I'd like to invite you all to call in within the next 20 minutes, and then for the next hour and a half after that, and share with us your own experience with growing up in a religion of your family tradition.
And remember, there may be a little bit of a delay in getting you on because Paula's probably in and out of the switchboard area. So if you don't get on the air right away, just hang in there. We'll get you on.
Exactly. Now, one of the papers in the Urantia book is paper 131 on the world's religions. Features a young Indian man, Ganad, who spent some time traveling around the Roman Empire with Jesus. Jesus was working for his father's merchant business as they traveled around, and he was hired as a tutor also for his son, Ganad. And Ganad probably spent more personal time with Jesus than any other person on the planet other than his brothers and sisters. And he was greatly impressed by Jesus' character and by his philosophy. And during their Alexandrian sojourn, this young man spent much of his time and no small sum of his father's money making a collection of the teachings of the world's religions about God and his relations with mortal man. Ganad employed more than 70 learned translators in the making of this abstract of the religious doctrines of the world concerning the deities. And it should be made plain that in this record that all these teachings portraying monotheism, meaning the belief in one God, were largely derived, directly or indirectly, from the preachments of the missionaries of Machiaventa Melchizedek, who went forth from their Salem headquarters to spread the doctrine of one God, the Most High, to the ends of the earth. And here I wanted to interrupt reading the quotes to just explain a little bit about Melchizedek, who in the Bible, in the very early parts of the Bible, is mentioned as the high priest of Salem. And in the Urantia book is the person who made the covenant with Abraham. Machiaventa Melchizedek was the third epical revelation to our world and was an emergency mission. He was incarnated as a human being here, as a full-grown human being, a man of that realm, of that age, who lived for many years and didn't age, didn't show any signs of aging, and then who, after his mission, just disappeared. And there's quite a bit of philosophical and religious doctrine that do mention Melchizedek. There's a priesthood under the order of Melchizedek, and most of his teachings are really the root of the religion that became Judaism. Are you on the same page with me, Andrea?
No, I'm not. I can be. I'm right here.
Okay.
I just wasn't following along. I was just listening. What you're on, 131?
Yeah, just section one. I can start with reading the next part on cynicism, and then I'm hoping you'll read the part on Judaism.
Okay.
The first religion that they discuss in this paper is cynicism, and that's paper 131, section 1, paragraph 1 in the Urantia book. The residual teachings of the disciples of Melchizedek, excepting those which persisted in the Jewish religion, were best preserved in the doctrines of the Cynics. Ganad's selection embraced the following. Quote, God is supreme. He is the Most High of heaven and earth. God is the perfected circle of eternity, and he rules the universe of universes. He is the sole maker of the heavens and the earth. When he decrees a thing, that thing is. Our God is one God, and he is compassionate and merciful. Everything that is high, holy, true, and beautiful is like our God. The Most High is the light of heaven and earth. He is the God of the east, the west, the north, and the south. Even if the earth should pass away, the resplendent face of the Supreme would abide in majesty and glory. The Most High is the first and the last, the beginning and the end of everything. There is but this one God, and his name is Truth. God is self-existent, and he is devoid of all anger and enmity. He is immortal and infinite. Our God is omnipotent and bounteous. While he has many manifestations, we worship only God himself. God knows all our secrets and our proclamations. He also knows what each of us deserves. His might is equal to all things. God is a peace giver and a faith protector of all who fear and trust him. He gives salvation to all who serve him. All creation exists in the power of the Most High. His divine love springs forth from the holiness of his power, and affection is born of the might of his greatness. The Most High has decreed the union of body and soul and has endowed man with his own spirit. What man does must come to an end. But what the Creator does goes on forever. We gain knowledge from the experience of man, we derive wisdom from the contemplation of the Most High. God pours rain upon the earth. He causes the sun to shine upon the sprouting grain. He gives us the abundant harvest of the good things of this life and eternal salvation in the world to come. Our God enjoys great authority. His name is excellent, and his nature is unfathomable. When you are sick, it is the Most High who heals you. God is full of goodness toward all men. We have no friend like the Most High. His mercy fills all places, and his goodness encompasses all souls. The Most High is changeless, and he is our helper in every time of need. Wherever you turn to pray, there is the face of the Most High and the open ear of our God. You may hide yourself from men, but not from God. God is not a great distance from us. He is omnipresent. God fills all places and lives in the heart of man, of the man who fears his holy name. Creation is in the Creator, and the Creator in his creation. We search for the Most High, and then find him in our hearts. You go in quest of a dear friend, and then you discover him within your soul. The man who knows God looks upon all men as equal. They are his brethren. Those who are selfish, those who ignore their brothers in the flesh, have only weariness as their reward. Those who love their fellows and who have pure hearts shall see God. God never forgets sincerity. He will guide the honest of heart into the truth, for God is truth. In your lives, overthrow error and overcome evil by the love of the living truth. In all your relations with men, do good for evil. The Lord God is merciful and loving. He is forgiving. Let us love God, for he first loved us. By God's love and through his mercy we shall be saved. Poor men and rich men are brothers. God is their Father. The evil you would not have done you, do not to others. At all times call upon his name, and as you believe in his name, so shall your prayer be heard. What a great honor it is to worship the Most High. All the worlds and the universes worship the Most High, and with all your prayers give thanks. Ascend to worship. Prayerful worship shuns evil and forbids sin. At all times, let us praise the name of the Most High. The man who takes shelter in the Most High conceals his defects from the universe. When you stand before God with a clean heart, you become fearless of all creation. The Most High is like a loving father and mother. He really loves us, his children on earth. Our God will forgive us and guide our footsteps into the ways of salvation. He will take us by the hand and lead us to himself. God saves those who trust him. He does not compel man to serve his name. If the faith of the Most High has entered your heart, then shall you abide free from fear throughout all the days of your life. Fret not yourself because of the prosperity of the ungodly. Fear not those who plot evil. Let the soul turn away from sin and put your whole trust in the God of salvation. The weary soul of the wandering mortal finds eternal rest in the arms of the Most High. The wise man hungers for the divine embrace. The earth child longs for the security of the arms of the Universal Father. The noble man seeks for that high estate wherein the soul of mortal blends with the spirit of the Supreme. God is just. What fruit we receive not from our plantings in this world, we shall receive in the next. Wow. That part
that
amazes
3,500 me. 3,500 years before Jesus?
Yes. Well, 2,500 before Jesus, I think. But anyway, it's really amazing that so much of the Melchizedek teachings still made it through all of those years in that ancient religion, that ancient philosophy, and how much of what was taught then was restated in the teachings of Jesus and in the teachings of Moses and all the prophets that followed after Melchizedek. I'm just amazed at how beautiful some of those quotes are.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any comments on that?
I think it's really interesting that this is such an advanced philosophy even for now, for these times that we're living in. A lot of people don't have how much of the truth that's here in the teachings of the cynics as we just read them. And, it is based on the teachings of Melchizedek, but obviously Jane had found this. Weren't they searching the library in Alexandria and they were able to pull all this together?
Yes.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
And what a huge loss we have to have lost that library of scrolls. What a tragedy.
Yeah. It makes you wonder why the celestials can't prevent something like that from happening when they know it's going to... I guess they can't...
We're a free will universe.
Yeah, it's got to be that way.
And it was the early Christians that burned most of those documents.
Incredible.
So we've got a few minutes left before we're going to open the phone lines for our callers. And if you wouldn't mind reading the selection he put together on Judaism, that will launch us into our discussion on that religion.
Can you hear me okay?
There's quite a bit of feedback.
Can you hear me better now? Can you hear me better now?
Yes.
Okay, good. Here we go. The Kenites of Palestine salvaged much of the teaching of Melchizedek, and from these records, as preserved and modified by the Jews, Jesus and Jane have made the following selection. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth and all things therein. And behold, all he created was very good. The Lord, he is God. There is none beside him in heaven above or upon the earth beneath. Therefore shall you love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. The earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. Day after day utters speech, night after night shows knowledge. There is no speech or language where their voice is not heard. The Lord's work is great, and in wisdom has he made all things. The greatness of the Lord is unsearchable. He knows the number of the stars. He calls them all by their names. The power of the Lord is great, and his understanding infinite. Says the Lord, as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts higher than your thoughts. God reveals the deep and secret things because the light dwells with him, the Lord is merciful and gracious. He is long-suffering and abundant in goodness and truth. The Lord is good and upright. The meek will he guide in judgment. Taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man who trusts God. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. The mercy of the Lord is from everlasting to everlasting upon those who fear him and his righteousness, even to our children's children. The Lord is gracious and full of compassion. The Lord is good to all, and his tender mercies are over all his creation. He heals the brokenhearted and binds up their wounds. Whither shall I go from God's Spirit? Whither shall I flee from the divine presence? Thus says the High and Lofty One who inhabits eternity, whose name is holy. I dwell in the high and holy place, also with him who is of a contrite heart and a humble spirit. None can hide himself from our God, for he fills heaven and earth. Let the heavens be glad, and let the earth rejoice. Let all nations say, the Lord reigns. Give thanks to God for his mercy endures forever. The heavens declare God's.
I'm going to just stop you for a second there. Is it? Are you in a public place by any chance with a lot of background noise?
That's correct.
Any possibility you can relocate? We're getting all of the background noise from the room you're in, and it's really hard to hear you.
Okay. Is that better?
Yep.
Is that better? Okay.
Yep.
Okay. Let's see. Where did I end there? To the children of men? Is that where I ended?
I'm sorry. I lost the space, the place, too.
Okay. I think that's where I was. So I'm going to continue with 131, paragraph 2, or section 2, paragraph 6. God
okay.
has made man a little less than divine, and has crowned him with love and mercy. The Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the ungodly shall perish. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. The knowledge of the Supreme is understanding. And says the Almighty God, walk before me and be perfect. Forget not that pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. He who rules his own spirit is mightier than he who takes the city, says the Lord God, the Holy One. In returning to your spiritual rest, shall you be saved. In quietness and confidence shall be your strength. They who wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not be faint. The Lord shall give you rest from your fear. Says the Lord, fear not, for I am with you. Be not dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. I will help you. Yes, I will uphold you with the right hand of my righteousness. God is our Father. The Lord is our Redeemer. God has created the universal host and preserves them all. His righteousness is like the mountains, and his judgment like the great deep. He causes us to drink of the river of his pleasures, and in his light we shall see light. It is good to give thanks to the Lord and sing praises to the Most High. Show forth loving kindness in the morning and the divine faithfulness every night. God's kingdom is everlasting, and his dominion is yours throughout all generations. I'm getting a lot of static now.
Yeah, we're still getting quite a bit.
The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in the paths of righteousness. Yes, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for God is with me. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Yahweh is the God of my salvation. Therefore, in the divine name will I put my trust. I will trust in the Lord with all my heart. I will lean not upon my own understanding. In all my ways I will acknowledge him. He shall direct my path. The Lord is faithful, and he keeps his word with those who serve him. The just shall live by his faith. If you do not, well, it is because sin lies at the door. Men reap the evil they plow and the sin they sow. Stress not yourself because of evildoers. If you regard iniquity in your heart, the Lord will not hear you. If you sin against God, you also wrong your own soul. God will bring every man's work to judgment, every secret thing, whether it be good or evil. As a man thinks in his heart, so is he. The Lord is near, all who call upon him in sincerity and in truth. Weeping may endure for a night, but joy comes in the morning. A merry heart does good like a medicine. No good thing will God withhold from those who walk uprightly. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. Thus says the Lord who created the heavens and who formed the earth. There is no God beside me, a just God and a Savior. Look to me and be saved, all the ends of the earth. If you seek me, you shall find me, if you search me with all your heart. The meek shall inherit the earth and shall delight themselves in the abundance of peace. Whoever sows iniquity shall reap calamity. They who sow the wind shall reap the whirlwind. Come now, let us reason together, says the Lord. Though your sins be as scarlet, they shall be as white as snow. Though they be red like crimson, they shall be as wool. But there is no peace for the wicked. It is your own sins which have withheld the good things from you. God is the help of my countenance and the joy of my soul. The eternal God is my strength. He is our dwelling place, and underneath are the everlasting arms. The Lord is near to those who are brokenhearted. He saves all who have a childlike spirit. Many are the afflictions of the righteous man, but the Lord delivers him out of them all. Commit your way to the Lord. Trust him. He will bring it to pass. He who dwells in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. Love your neighbor as yourself. Bear a grudge against no man. Whatsoever you hate to do, whatsoever you hate, do to no man. Love your brother, for the Lord has said, I will love my children freely. The path of the just is as a shining light, which shines more and more until the perfect day. They who are wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament. They turn many to the righteousness as the stars forever and ever. But the wicked forsake his evil way, and the unrighteous man his rebellious thoughts. Says the Lord, let them return to me, and I will have mercy on them. I will abundantly pardon. Says God, the creator of heaven and earth, great peace of they who love my law, my commandments are, you shall love me with all your heart. You shall have no gods before me. You shall not take my name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Honor your father and mother. You shall not kill. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness. You shall not covet. To all who have to love the Lord supremely and their neighbors like themselves, God of heaven says, I will ransom you from the grave. I will redeem you from death. I will be merciful to your children as well as just. Have I not said of my creatures on earth, you are the sons of the living God? And have I not loved you with an everlasting love? Have I not called you to become like me and to dwell forever with me in paradise? And that's the end of that section.
All right. Thanks.
Yeah.
Good job. It's a long one.
Yeah. Yeah. It, you know, there's more fear than I heard in the first one. You know, more of a, you shall fear the Lord, which you didn't hear with the cynics.
There were a couple of lines from the cynics that talked about fearing the name of God, but for the most part, they talk about love, the love of God, and the
more of a friendship kind of approach.
Yeah, that he is mm-hmm. your friend. When you seek God, you seek your friend, and you find him in your own heart.
Mm-hmm.
And, but I think that the influence of other prophets are and other teachers are starting to influence in this writing more so than in this with the Synex.
All right. They say these records as preserved and modified by the Jews. So they put their own spin on it.
And it was a very, I think, a rich and a dynamic religion in that it really promoted the idea of discussion and debate amongst its students, its followers, which is one of the things that I think is unique in Judaism. From my understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I wanted to ask...
As long as those people were men, because back then they didn't really allow women to become involved.
True, indeed. Well, I wanted to ask Paula if we have any other callers. I don't know if you're listening, Paula, but we're waiting for a call from one of our listeners. Now, are you able to be on the board at all?
Well, I didn't try, and the reason I didn't try is because I'm afraid if I try and connect and override her connection, it's going to drop the whole program.
Okay. I just put the caller through. Caller 714 is on with you guys right now.
Oh.
Hello.
I bet this is Mark.
It is Mark.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
Morning.
Good morning.
I am fine. Nice to be with you.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Well,
you know something about the Jewish religion, don't you?
Born, raised, bar mitzvahed, certified, and circumcised.
Yeehaw.
Good to know.
Well, maybe you can tell us a little bit about your experience. Growing up in that wonderful tradition?
Well, yes, the tradition is wonderful, and I'm very proud to have had that as a major part of my past. However, my personal experience with Judaism had its ups and downs, and probably one of the main reasons why I became a searcher after truth at a very early age.
And what were some of the things that you experienced in your religious upbringing that made you hungry for truth or made you feel the need to seek truth in your life?
My family was wonderful, and all of our Jewish friends were wonderful. My father never actually converted to Judaism, but accepted the faith almost wholeheartedly. In fact, he was a very active member of the Jewish war veterans from a very early age and from a very early part of our involvement and participation when we were just little kids. But
so your mom was Jewish and your dad was not?
My dad was never converted to Judaism. No, he was born and raised a Protestant and remained so to the end, yes.
And what was your mother's background?
Oh, she was Jewish.
Right, but what was her history?
Well, we were never really Orthodox Jews. The family had, at least my grandfather had come to, it's kind of a complicated story, but my grandfather came from Russia, where the family were very wealthy landowners and they provided all the meat for the Tsar's armies in Russia, and when the Russian Revolution came along in the very early part of the 19th century, the 20th century, the
20th century.
They had to get out of there, and he and my grandmother ended up back in the United States. Like I say, we're never really Orthodox Jews, but the interesting thing that happened to me was, like, when it came time for me to get to have my bar mitzvah, it was a very important thing to me. especially since I represented my religion to a family that was split with down the middle with, well, actually, we were split with more than, we had a lot of Protestants and we had a lot of Catholics. And so I really wanted to kind of make a nice showing for my religion. And however, the same rabbi that I was raised with suddenly did the holier-than-thou thing and would not bar mitzvah me unless my father would convert to Judaism.
Oh, really?
And
is that a normal traditional viewpoint?
I don't know. At that particular time, of course, you know, I just turned 67, so you know the time frame we're talking about. And at that point, we didn't really have any reason to know a whole lot of rabbis, so we didn't know where he was coming from. We just knew we had to find another rabbi. And that was probably the most wonderful thing that ever really ended up happening to me, because we found a rabbi that was young and bright, handsome, and he actually was a rabbi that had a Sunday morning radio show. The synagogue wasn't far away, so it was fairly convenient, and it was probably the best thing that ever happened to me.
Wow. Had you gone to shul before that time? Had you been studying on a regular basis from early on in your childhood?
I took the whole thing pretty seriously. Yeah, and I went quite often, and I didn't really have to be. I really didn't have to be dragged there. I went quite willingly, and I started reading the Old Testament at a pretty young age. And there were some questions. I always wondered why it said when I read the Adam and Eve part, when Cain slew Abel. I always wondered why he left the garden and went to the land of Nod and took a wife. I always wondered where she came from.
Hmm.
But no one
Indeed.
Ever could tell me. They just kind of told me, oh, those are just allegories. Those are just stories. Just sort of take it for what it's worth. Of course, I never really did totally. So it was wonderful to find the Urantia book later on in life and find out where who Nod was and who all those people were.
And the more expanded story of Adam and Eve, which most people really love.
Of course. But that's how that
So tell us about your new rabbi, and how did he influence you? What were his positive
teachings? Well, he was
teachings.
Young and bright and very understanding of my situation, being in a mixed marriage. And he kind of took on the challenge too, and he even made, for instance, one of the things that happened was the synagogue, which was a few miles away from the original synagogue, was about to receive a brand new Torah, which is the five books of Moses, which is the Old Testament, which is what the Jewish faith keeps carefully housed away in an ark
it's the first few books of the Bible, right? It's not the entire Old Testament.
Well, what are they? Genesis, Exodus, what are the other
Leviticus.
Three books? No, that's the Torah, at any rate.
Mm-hmm.
The Torahs, that are actually read in a Jewish synagogue, I don't know if you know very much about Hebrew, but Hebrew can be read by people who really know Hebrew without any vowels. And the vowels in Hebrew are little dots and lines that help the people that don't know Hebrew get through reading Hebrew. I was taught my portion of that I was to read on my bar mitzvah so carefully and so precisely that I was actually allowed to be the first person to read their bar mitzvah portion directly out of that Torah without any of those vowels.
Wow.
And it was a remarkable experience for me. I was very, very proud of what I was able to accomplish. And they carefully taught me, and they knew that I knew what I was reading, so that they were very comfortable with, like, letting me read directly from the brand new Torah. And instead of, like, what most bar mitzvah boys and girls nowadays, bar mitzvah and bat mitzvah, girls are bat mitzvah and boys are bar mitzvah, but most of them have, like, a book where they're kind of reading a transliteration, if you know what I mean. In other words, they're speaking Hebrew, but it's really English letters that they're reading that are instead of the actual Hebrew. That happens quite a bit nowadays in modern Judaism.
Did you have to learn both the ancient Hebrew and the English Hebrew then?
Well, I did, but really, let's be honest, it was really basically enough to get through this kind of a special bar mitzvah. And after that happened, and because of my other question about the Bible, I sort of fell off and in a fairly early age also, and I didn't really keep it up for very long after that because I just had too many questions that nobody could really answer for me to my satisfaction. So after that young experience, that young intense experience of Judaism, I sort of kind of just became the wandering Jew for a while.
Wandered in the desert.
Until I met my wife, and then we settled on something. Then we negotiated a middle ground and raised our one son and our nephew in the Church of Religious Science later on. So I really am a walking monument to interfaith because I've got one thing after another going on, and it was just kind of a fun thing, especially nowadays.
Well, what were some of the things that you liked about growing up in the Jewish faith?
I loved the people. They were the best part. You know, they were just some of the most loving, warmest, caring, crazy people, especially my own family. Oh, my gosh, my own family had all kinds of strange folks, and the fact that they could all be thinking all these different things and still be part of the same religion was a remarkable thing for me. That the diversity of my own religion within my own religion was probably
and that was acceptable and encouraged or. Embraced.
Yeah. Yes, actually. Of course, it drove some of my family members crazy, but for the most part, everybody loved everybody.
We're told in the Urantia book that one of the things that makes Judaism such a strong religion is the strength of its family culture.
That's true.
The strength of the family.
And I
would guess that because it's traditionally the man is the head of the household or the head of the family, that might have been why you're the more conservative rabbi felt that it was crucial for your father to be Jewish in order to be the head of the family in a traditional Jewish household.
Yes, but it's the mother who carries the Jewish blood.
Right.
And no matter what ever happens or what I ever believe or what I ever convert to, or it wouldn't really normally matter to the Jewish community or the Jewish culture or Jewish society.
Because you would always be Jewish.
I am still Jewish. And if I just might make a point, because it's kind of interesting, especially in this political environment that we live in, it's a little different for Islam. In Islam, it's the father that carries the blood. So there's a reason. So one of the justifications for an awful lot of people thinking of our president as being Muslim, as a matter of fact, is because of his father being Muslim. No matter what a lot of people say or think, or what he says or thinks, the Muslim world thinks of President Barack Obama as being a Muslim.
Right, because that's critical in their tradition.
I didn't know that.
A lot of people don't know that.
So even though women don't have the same place in the temple as men, in Jewish tradition, women still hold a very prominent place in the lineage and in the training of the children.
Well, yes, and let me clarify one other very important point with regard to the comparison of Judaism and Islam, that even though there is a tendency and there is a tradition of separation between men and women in the Jewish religion, there is total equality between the two sects. There are all kinds of strange reasons for the separation of the sects in Judaism, and only in traditional Orthodox Judaism, let me also emphasize, not in modern, contemporary, or conservative, or
Reformed.
Reformed Judaism, those separations hardly even exist any longer, but in Orthodox Judaism, there's still the separation, but there's still total equality, whereas in Islam, there is the separation, and I'm afraid to say there's a great evidence that there is not equality either.
Well, and that is also changing in more Reformed Islam as well. And when talking to imams and other contemporary Muslim teachers, one of the reasons that they give, and frankly I've been told by rabbis this is the reason for the separation of men from the women in the temple, is that when people are worshiping, especially if the worshiping involves bowing down onto the floor, that keeping the women behind the men keeps the men from being distracted by looking at women or seeing women or being aware of women being there, so that their minds can fully concentrate on God. Because men tend to be distracted by women, and that it is not meant to be a this, now I'm talking from the point of view of the rabbi that I spoke to, that this was not a an attempt to denigrate the women, but to respect them. And, you know, for men not to be thinking lewd or lascivious thoughts, but for them to be focused, you know, exclusively on God while they're in the temple worshiping. And I thought, well, you know, that might not go over really well with everyone, but it made sense to me. I remember my brother.
It sounds like a stretch to me, to tell you the truth.
Well, I remember my brother sharing his experience of going to school in China in the early 80s, shortly after China had been opened up to Westerners following the visit of Nixon to China. There was a professor who had come to his university and had invited his senior class of architecture students to come to the university at Tianjin for a semester. And my brother said he was really impressed by the lack of advertising and fashion and other types of stimuli that, you know, the women were all really covered up. They all sort of wore the same Mao uniform or outfit. And he said that there he was able to study with very little distraction from the constant bombardment of sexual images interfering with his study. And most college-age men are, you know, at the height of their sexuality, I suppose, and it can be very distracting. And he said for the first time in his life, having been raised a fairly liberal sort of fellow, he started to understand the reason for keeping women more modestly attired and not having that constant, I guess you'd say, influence or distraction. And he said he returned to the U.S. with a really different frame of mind. And he's always been very egalitarian. You know, he's definitely a feminist man. But I thought that was an interesting thing for him to share. So from that perspective, I think it makes some sense.
Well, it's a good excuse. I just not buying it. But, you know, I just it's just old-time religion. You know, it's fine.
Well, I mean, and that instruction flows through a lot of religion.
I think as far as Judaism is concerned, I think it's interesting to go back and particularly since we have the Urantia book, to see the clear portrayal of the equality that existed, for instance, between Joseph and Mary in the raising of not only Jesus but the rest of the children. She was always considered, her feelings, her thoughts, you know, her input was always an important consideration for Joseph in the raising of the kids. And what other thing is there that could be more important? It existed in Judaism from the very get-go, and I love being able to discover that.
Well, and in my experience, most of the Jewish families that I've known intimately, the women have had quite a bit of power in the family.
Oh, you have no idea.
I kind of do.
Boy, they.
Boy, they.
So what might be the official teaching and what is the actual reality, it's very clear that women wield a lot of power in Judaism.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and always have. Well, a lot of power, you know, it depends on the thing. You know, it varies from family to family, but there's always been a general acceptance of equal power and equal input, equal, you know, that sort of thing. And in my family in particular, we had Hanukkah in the family room and Christmas in the living room. It was just the way it was.
And did you grow up with any exposure to Christianity philosophically as well, or just with the
Whenever I visited the other grandmother, I would go to church. And we would go to whatever church she got a postcard from.
Interesting.
Yeah, it was interesting. It was very interesting. Yeah.
What was that, Andrea?
I like what Mark said, how he was a walking monument to the interfaith movement.
I grew up in neighborhoods where I, you know, like there might have been two or three Jews amongst a sea of Caucasian Christian and Catholics. So I've always been a minority, no matter what I've done.
And did you feel ostracized in any way, or was it a fairly interfaith accepting community?
Well, you know what, my upbringing, my family, but the strength of my family and the strength of my religious upbringing made me feel like I was the most important person in the world. I never felt any other different. I felt everybody may have been different, but I was just as there was something about me. I never had any doubt about the fact that I was just as important and just as viable as everybody else.
So you weren't hampered by a low self-esteem or a sense of lack of self-worth?
Well, I couldn't play football. But I got over that, you know. Jewish people are not, Jewish kids are not known for their athleticism. Anyway.
Well, I wanted to just go back to, you know, where we started quite a while ago, where we were talking about the Torah, and I just wanted to update our listeners. It says that the Torah is the Jewish name for the first five books of the Jewish Bible. In Hebrew, the five books are named by the first phrase in the text. And you probably have to help me with the pronunciation. But Bereshit, in the beginning, the book of Genesis. Shemot, names, Exodus. Vayikra, he called, Leviticus. Bamidbar, in the desert, Numbers. And Devarim, words, Deuteronomy. So that would be Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. In rabbinic literature, the word Torah denotes these first five books.
Beautiful job on the pronunciation.
Pardon me?
Beautiful job on the pronunciation.
Oh, really?
Oh,
well, that
so.
Was just a fluke. The oral Torah, or Torah Shabel Peh, Torah that is spoken, the oral Torah consists of the traditional interpretations and amplifications handed down by word of mouth from generation to generation and now embodied in the Talmud and the Midrash. According to Jewish tradition, all the laws found in the Torah, both written and oral, were given by God to Moses, some of them at Mount Sinai, and most of them at the tabernacle. And all the teachings were later compiled and written down by Moses, which resulted in the Torah we have today. According to medieval Jewish mysticism, the Torah was created prior to the creation of the world and was used as the blueprint for creation. Most modern biblical scholars believe that the written books were a product of the Babylonic exile period, 600 BCE, and that it was completed by the Persian period, 400 BCE. Anyway, that's just a little bit of historical reference. Thanks to Wikipedia.
I'm learning something new. Which I always do on Saturday mornings.
When I was studying at the Boulder School, studying intensively the Urantia book, we had to choose a religion of the world, or we were assigned a religion of the world that we had to do intensive study on. And I was assigned Judaism, which was ironic because I majored in comparative religions in college, and I had studied all the Eastern religions and some of the more esoteric religions, but I hadn't really done a lot of study of the three Semitic religions, or the Abrahamic traditions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam.
Crystal?
And I, yep.
I just put another call on with you guys. It's area code 303. Just letting you know.
All right. Terrific.
Okay.
Well, let's take another caller then. 303, you're on the air with Cosmic Citizen.
Crystal,
hello?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Crystalline, can you hear me?
Yes. Can you hear
it's
me?
Ron.
Hi, Ron.
I've
thanks
been
for
hearing
calling
you
in.
All along as you were talking to the other Jewish gentleman.
Well, Mark, meet Ron. Ron, meet Mark.
Hello,
how
Mark.
How do you do, Ron? I have an interesting story you might get a kick out of.
Please tell.
Well, I was 5 years old when my family emigrated to Israel from East European country. And
where in Eastern
by
Europe?
By the time I was 7 years old, I guess with the mind of a seven-year-old, I'd already been exposed to the what I thought at the time were the three world religions. I didn't know that there were any more than that. I was confused enough with the fact that there were three of them. I had not been brought up in any specific religious doctrine for a variety of reasons, and maybe that kind of was to my advantage for what happened next. Because,
where did you come from originally? What was the Eastern European country where you started?
Bulgaria.
And was it already behind the Iron Curtain at that time?
Yes, it was.
So
in
that
fact,
might have been one of
the main
the
reason
reasons
why we were able to leave is that Bulgaria always had a very benevolent view towards its Jewish population. My father had been born to the Jewish faith, but he had become way, way ahead of his time. In his early youth, became a vegetarian and a follower of a movement known as the White Brotherhood, which was totally pacifist and, followed Judeo-Christian teachings, if you will, but you couldn't call it Christian. It was certainly not Jewish. If it was anything, it would have been closest to Christianity, but a very enlightened form that did not practice specific doctrine of any kind. So my parents were way ahead of their time in many respects, and I don't remember at home being indoctrinated to do anything other than to be a very upright, the difference between right and wrong. And I mean, at age five, I don't remember any specific teaching as such. So
well, that's
between
really
five
interesting.
And seven, arriving in Israel, you might say was kind of my first realization that different people had different, quote, religions, whatever that meant. And so my seven-year-old mind had trouble with these three different perspectives. And as I saw them, and I'm sure I'm paraphrasing, but in my mind, taking Christianity first, believed that unless you accept Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior, you will burn in hell. And
right.
Judaism, unless you were one of the, you were the chosen people, and unless you were lucky enough to be part of the chosen few, you're sheer out of luck. It's just tough luck. And if you're a Muslim, you have to believe in Allah and His Prophet Muhammad, and if you didn't, you're an infidel, and you probably deserve to die. And somehow, by age seven, those three views or simplistic characterizations, as I saw them, of the religions, it was clear to me that all three could not be right simultaneously. And therefore, the next thought that crossed my mind was that if one was right, the other two, out of sheer necessity, had to be at least on some level wrong. Now, that presented me with an interesting dilemma, because what that meant was that unless it was kind of like an accident of birth would determine whether you were born on the right side or the wrong side of the tracks. And that fundamentally offended my seven-year-old's sense of fair play.
Wow.
I had real trouble with that. And so I went to my dad, and I asked him, did God create man, or did man create God? And I clearly remember him nearly falling off his chair. He was sitting down.
Wow.
All I can tell you, you know, without getting into too much detail, is that as a result of that I didn't know I was, you know, that led to my becoming an atheist, at least for the early years of my life, but certainly through my teenage and early college, I was definitely an atheist. Was somewhere between college and my
30s. How long were you in Israel?
I was in Israel for 13 years, from age 5 to 18. At age 18, I came to the U.S. as a foreign student.
Okay.
And I've been here ever since.
Sorry to keep interrupting you. Just love the details. When you were in Israel, were you studying as a Jew, or were you participating in a Jewish community?
There is no such thing as a Jewish community. Israel is technically all Jewish, with the exception of the minority population of the Arab, Palestinian origin, who were there, you know, before Israel became a state.
What about secular Jews?
Well, the secular, I mean, the majority of Israel when I was there was certainly secular, without a doubt.
Oh, really?
In fact, they were so secular that I'd almost say they're on the verge of not being far from my, they were Jewish in name, but not in practice. I mean, if they went to the synagogue, they might go once a year. Once a year on the Day of Atonement, kind of the equivalent of Christians who only go to church on Easter Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Vast majority were there, at least that I was exposed to, the vast majority were very anti-ultra-Orthodox religious people who wielded then and probably still do probably a disproportionate amount of political power than represented by their numbers. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I remember hearing grumblings by, everybody I knew was Jewish. Okay? I didn't think of them as Jews. I thought of them as Israelis. And in fact, for the longest time, I thought of myself as an Israeli. Nothing Jewish. Just as Israeli, it was a nationalistic view,
mm-hmm.
and I remember most Israelis not being particularly amused by ambulances getting stoned in certain quarters if they were to show up on an emergency run on a Sabbath, you know, because they're violating the Sabbath in effect. I mean that kind of thing at the time was really very. The majority that, at least that I was exposed to, was not particularly amused or supportive of. Now, things may have changed in the last 50 years, because I left literally 50 years ago this year. When you say, did I live in the Jewish community, everything was technically Jewish or Israeli, as distinguished from Palestinian. There were very, very few Palestinians. Now, by the time I was 9 years old, and, it became apparent, at least to my parents, that it might be nice for me to learn foreign languages, given their experience of coming from Bulgaria without one, and finding how difficult it is to go around the world with only your native tongue. And so I was enrolled in a French Catholic missionary school where English, well, French was a first language, English and Hebrew were secondary.
Really? How interesting.
Yeah. And,
now, did you have any? Did you have any memory of Bulgarian?
To this day, I probably can still speak it. Though, unfortunately, even though I can speak it on a more or less fluent level, my vocabulary is that of a 5-year old.
Yeah, yeah, that of a kid.
Very.
And you probably don't have that many opportunities.
I've had a couple of opportunities, and it's really funny that relatives from Bulgaria who don't realize that I'm limited with my vocabulary, trying to maintain an adult conversation limited with limited vocabulary can make it for a very interesting exchange.
I have the same experience going back to Africa and in Ghana, because I spoke the native language without an accent. You know, I spoke it as if I was a native. But my vocabulary was so limited that after a very short while, I'd be completely lost. And they would expect me to be
exactly
fluent because my accent was
exactly
so good.
That's exactly the way I speak Bulgarian, with a Bulgarian accent. They would not know. And very, very strange. Now, my Hebrew, which was fluent, it was probably fluent for about 10 years after I left. And it's amazing how it literally went off a cliff about 10 years later. And I've never been able to revive it. I mean, I can read it without any trouble at all. But listening to the spoken word, it's almost like, first of all, if it's very fluently spoken, I can't keep track of it. If it's spoken slowly, there's like a 30-second tape delay in my brain. Like 30 seconds after I heard what I heard, I understood what I heard. And if the thing keeps on rolling, then I'm falling behind. Very, very strange. Okay.
How's your French?
Anyway. my French, my French was fluent, certainly. Well, I was in the French school for 3 years. And then switched next door to a Scottish missionary school where English was the first language, because I was really more interested in English than I was in French, and I wanted to master English more so than French. So my French was, treading water, if you will, after I left the French school, because the French that they taught at the English school, was on a par with the Hebrew that they were teaching. I didn't really learn anything new to speak of. I was way ahead of everybody else in the class. And the only good thing about my French is that the way I was taught French, in such a way that you learn phonetics first.
Mm-hmm.
So I never learned any words or vocabulary with my own innate pronunciation, whatever that might have been. So I can read and speak French with a Parisian accent, but I'm no longer fluent by any means.
Mm-hmm.
So you might say my French is somewhere similar to the same place where my Hebrew is.
Okay. And how did studying at these different schools influence you philosophically? Were you also studying religion courses when you were at those schools, or were you still getting
part
a very secular education?
I don't remember any religious courses while I was at the French school. As soon as the priests, the Catholic brothers who ran the school, found out that I was not Jewish, they assumed I was Christian, and I was expected to attend catechism.
Were you ever bar mitzvahed?
No. I was never raised in the Jewish faith.
Okay.
So to my father, and I said, what if, he says, oh, you don't need to go to catechism. Tell him you're a free Christian. And so I went to the priest, and I said, je suis un chrétien libre. And I can still remember his his, you know, his eyes kind of squinting and his, you know, frown on his forehead. He's trying to figure out what the hell is a free Christian, but the long and the short of it is I did not need to attend catechism anymore.
Oh, that's
interesting. And that was the end of that. You know, as I said, nothing interfered with my atheism. And the atheism, I'd say, in my 20s, probably changed to agnosticism. You know, I'm from Missouri. Show me. I remember thinking more than once as I was listening to either talk shows like this or any religious conversation where my attitude was, you know, if you could prove to me that there is a God, even if you could, that wouldn't change the way I live my life because I live my life in a very ethical, blah, blah. I mean, I didn't see at the time that that would have made any difference in how I was brought up, you know, by the golden rule and, you know, the values and so on. It's just that my parents saw no practical point with the way I confronted them with the dichotomies of the different religions at that young age to try to give me any sort of doctrine. Not that they were following a doctrine as such. They were much more, as I said, ahead of their time.
And were your parents still basically people of faith, having come out of the White Brotherhood in Bulgaria?
The White Brotherhood, if you think of it as
it's a pretty progressive religion, actually. I mean, if you go back
and study it, it was a Bulgarian philosopher
who really believed that it taught everybody, regardless of race, religion, social position, intellectual ability, or material means, is able to take part in the realization of a new period of brotherhood and peace on earth. And
the founder of that movement, Peter Dunov was his name, and he apparently was very, very close to my maternal grandfather.
Oh, really?
So my mother was steeped in that movement, and that's how she met my dad. My dad, who had been essentially disowned by his Jewish family because he was greatly influenced by the writings of Leo Tolstoy. He was a disciple of Leo Tolstoy. He had somehow discovered the White Brotherhood and became a follower of the movement, and that's where my parents met.
Interesting.
And my maternal
for our
grandfather.
Listeners, I would highly recommend that you just look up the Universal White Brotherhood on Wikipedia and see some of the history and some of the philosophy, because it's really interesting.
Well, as I started to say, my maternal grandfather and the master, as Peter Dunov was known, a teacher, if you will, for the movement, the two of them made the trek at the early part of the last century to the Holy Land, which is a big deal.
Hmm.
I mean, to go from Bulgaria to Palestine back in those days and to Jerusalem, I mean, I have no idea. You know, you didn't call up American Express and book your tickets. I mean, it wasn't a simple thing in those.
How long did it take you to make that pilgrimage? Did you go directly to Jerusalem, or did you have to go through a lot of other countries to get there?
Not me. I'm talking about my maternal grandfather and the master. They did it about 100 years ago.
Oh, I see. Okay.
I have no idea. That's why I'm saying I can't even imagine how they did that.
But that was part of their practice, was this pilgrimage to the Holy Land.
Right. So they were very much espousing teachers. Yeah, I mean, the teachings of Jesus by whatever means they had them, you know, and understood them to be. I do not know. I don't know if they had any special sacred text or I have no idea.
Okay.
I know that they, part of their practice was doing calisthenics early morning at sunrise in a group setting. Calisthenics and singing, going around in a huge circle on a mountain meadow. Obviously, summertime.
Fascinating.
Yeah. Those are some of the stories and pictures I've seen and I've heard. That's
Were you saying something,
that.
Mark?
Yeah, I was hoping I might be able to let you all in on something kind of fun that I'm involved with that's coming up that shows you like what I've got myself involved with lately.
Yeah.
Can I butt
sure,
in
go ahead.
Kind of let I am about to give my first sermon. I sort of have come to this, made this transition into like my life is sort of a ministry these days, and I just find myself in a position that, well, here's what happened. I attend the Unitarian Church here in Anaheim, and on Christmas morning, which was a Sunday morning, the service part of it was a presentation by another lay member who gave this salacious, ugly version of the Christmas story to these other secular atheists and agnostic Unitarians, and it just blew me away. I just could not believe what I was hearing. Anyway, I talked to the guy and said, you know, can't you give the Christmas story of the benefit of the doubt that you don't know that that Joseph and Mary weren't married? And he said, oh, yes, he did, and he sent me the Bible and all this sort of thing. Anyway, long story short, I asked him if I could please have some equal time to give a different version. And so they just coincidentally gave me Palm Sunday, and I'm going to be giving my first sermon, and this gay Jewish Urantia book reader is about to defend the life and teachings of Jesus to a bunch of secular Unitarians on Palm Sunday in downtown Anaheim across the street from the Anaheim Police Department. And
I wish I could be there.
I cannot
believe that this turn of events has come about. I'm very excited about it. We do have a potluck lunch afterwards. Anybody who might be listening to me in the region that might be interested in listening to it, I think we're going to have a lot of fun. I think I'm going to shake them up a little bit with my version, and it should be interesting.
Good for you.
Well, it's a bit ironic today that on the show when we're trying to find out what it's really like growing up in the Jewish faith with Jewish values, we have two guys calling in who are so open to, you know, Christianity and or the life and teachings of Jesus. Because
yeah.
I would say that's not really a typical response from traditional Jews.
They really aren't traditional Jews, either one of them.
Well, we couldn't really be traditional Jews and be Urantia book readers at the same time, not for very long anyway.
Right.
I have to tell you, though, it was not easy for me. I approached the Urantia book from part three, which is parallels the Old Testament, because I was totally comfortable and it answered all those questions I had in my early Jewish upbringing, and I had to take a long, hard gulp and a deep breath before I went into part four, and because it was the first time I'd ever really met the master, and, you know, and thank God it didn't happen until I was in my 60s, that I didn't have to overcome any traditional Christianity in my past. I was a clean sheet of paper for accepting the life and teachings of Jesus, and I feel so lucky and so fortunate that I found this book and found this story and found the master, you know, at this point in my life, and I can't wait to tell everybody else about it.
How did you come about it? Did you were you a Unitarian Universalist before you found the Urantia book? Or
well,
where
you
were you in
churches? Because it's got a great big gay pride flag on its corner, shining right into the administrative offices of the Anaheim Police Department across the street. And, you know, now I have a male partner. After 34 years of marriage to a wonderful woman, I now have a male partner, and I thought that might be a place where we might find a home, which we have. They're wonderful people. They're very interesting, but they are half atheist, agnostic, and secular. And it makes for a wonderful conversation every Sunday morning. But that's only been for about the last year and a half that I've been a Unitarian. And my wife and I raised our one son and our nephew in the Church of Religious Science. That was
okay.
Sort of a negotiated middle ground between my Judaism and her Christian Science background.
Well, I'll bet Ron can relate to that too, can't you, Ron? Because you also attended the Church of Religious Science, didn't you?
Are we talking about Ernest Holmes Religious Science?
Yeah, we sure are.
Okay, that's Mile High. Yeah, that's Mile High Church. Yeah, let's put it this way. I spent a fair amount of time learning about Religious Science, and I could see the conflict between the UB and Religious Science, and finally realized that it's 90% psychology and maybe a little bit of smattering of spirituality.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Andrea.
I was going to ask
the verdict of Religious
Science,
anyway.
What did you see as the... Because I attend a Church of Religious Science, Ernest Holmes Church, in my hometown, and I am pleasantly surprised every Sunday by the sermon and by what is given out, and I haven't found any big discrepancies or, you know, issues between that and the Urantia book. What were you finding that didn't sit right with you?
I didn't find that in the service. Where I discovered it is when I took classes and we got into debates and we really studied, you know, the full, I guess you might say, their equivalent of the Bible or UB, the writings of Ernest Holmes.
The underlying
philosophy. And I began
philosophy.
To realize, well, yeah, it's more philosophy. It, first of all, Religious Science is, you might say, a belief system that all came from deductive reasoning of Ernest Holmes. It's not revelatory. It's Ernest Holmes looking at the world and deciding this is the way it works. And I'll tell you where I began to realize the problem. When we started to talk about evil, and the rest of the class were trying to tell me that there is no such thing, it's just an illusion. It doesn't exist. Okay? If you think it exists, it's an illusion, because there's no separation, we and God are one. Well, the UB does not say that we and God are one. He's the creator, we're the creation. That's not one. In Religious Science, if I understand what I learned in the classes, there is no distinction. We're all part of one, and there is no distinction, and therefore, because there is no distinction, since God is good, there can't be any evil. And all I can say is if you really believe that, you might want to read People of the Lie by Scott Peck, and you might change your mind.
Yeah, that book was very impactful for me when I read it, too.
Say the title again, please.
People of the Lie, L-I-E, like lying?
Right.
I think it was his third or fourth bestseller after The Road Less Traveled. But
is his signature, you know,
yeah,
relationship Bible, if you will.
Right. And then he goes into talking about community and building community, and then he talks about his experience as a psychiatrist dealing with the type of sociopathic mind. Psychopaths,
yeah,
and sociopaths,
so
but primarily the sociopath. And he talks about the kind of mental disturbances that psychiatry has almost no effect on, no positive effect on. And it would be the equivalent to probably what the Urantia book would describe as iniquity, an iniquitous,
yeah,
personality choice where evil has been embraced fully and there's nothing that anybody can do to turn someone away from that path once it's fully embraced. And it's a pretty intense and somewhat frightening look into the dark side of humanity.
Well, contemporary, take a look at the leadership in Syria and what's going on there right now. Do you have any doubt about evil existing?
Well, and we have many examples of that throughout the 20th century at various really despotic leaders who just massacred huge quantities of their population. You know, anyway, it can be pretty scary to look in that direction. And I think that one of the benefits that we have in, you know, believing in or having faith in God and having faith in truth, beauty, and goodness as the primary realities of divinity is that we can acknowledge that evil exists and that it is a choice that free will necessitates, really, but that it isn't something that has to frighten us or unduly influence us. You know, we can choose the one over the other. And we're also assured that goodness will triumph over evil eventually. But getting back to your history, Ron, when you moved to the United States and you were pretty much agnostic, and we kind of cut you off at that point, and I'd like to invite you to carry on. We've still got another 20 minutes or so of the program.
Okay. I guess my my personal journey, you know, the agnosticism, I'm not sure which came first, but I was greatly moved for a short while by Ayn Rand while I was in college reading Atlas Shrugged. And I remember waking up one day and saying, do I really believe this? This isn't me. The virtue of selfishness? Selfishness is a virtue?
Yeah.
It was like, hey, are you serious? And it was like a wake-up call without anybody hitting me on the head. I mean, it was like I finally hit myself on the head. I said, this is ridiculous. Doesn't make any sense at all. And so I sort of floundered around and, you know, I just had no ideas. And it wasn't until I was 40 years of age and my daughter was born, and I was there during the live birth and the whole experience, and it finally hit me that there was way, I mean, when I thought about all the things that had to come together for this human being to come into being, you know, with perfect toes, and I mean, it was a profound effect to where I woke up to the realization of causality, if you will, or at least intelligent design. In other words, be it the biology and the chemistry and whatever else had to come together for this human being to come into existence, I remember somebody saying to me, if you took a Swiss movement watch apart and took all the little cogs and wheels and springs and whatnot and put them in a lunch paper sack and put your hand over the lid and then shook it, how long would you have to shake it to be able to open the bag and find the watch reassembled again?
Right.
And I thought, wow. I mean, that seemed like a very vivid and simple, easy to relate to example. I thought, that does, I guess, you know, if you had enough shakes, you'd ultimately wind up opening the bag and there'd be dust in it, but you would not have the watch put together again. And so that's
so that
I
turned out to be
I
a real spiritual awakening
of,
experience.
Well, I became what I would describe as a deist. I did not know much about deity, but I had to assume that it was there. There was something.
You had had
superhuman.
The experience of a creator.
Yeah. And I remember, interestingly enough, my wife, by the time my daughter was like 2 or 3 years of age, my wife was a Reformed Catholic, wasn't going to church anyway. And she says, you know, we should start taking our daughter to church, at least to introduce her. So we decided to go to a local church, which was a United Church of Christ. I should rephrase that. We didn't decide until she said the magic words, because I had no interest in going to church. Magic words were, you know, you don't have to come to the service. They actually have a very interesting old minister that runs the Sunday school for the adults, and he is known to answer, be happy to answer any question. He doesn't take offense whatsoever. You can ask him anything you want about religion, you name it, your doubts, etc. He's very happy to accommodate. And I said, really? Okay, I'm in. So while she would go sing in the choir, my daughter would be in the child care program, I would be in the adult class. And it wasn't long before I became known as the irreverent soul who would ask all the questions that nobody else had the cojones to bring up. And during break, they would come up to me and egg me on and say, keep on. And, you know, I've been wanting to ask that. It was kind of like, why didn't you? But so I kept on doing that. And
wow, I need to interrupt you. I need to interrupt you just 1 second, if I may. Just because you were just talking about the spiritual impact of the birth of your daughter, I was just interrupted by my husband calling to say that 1 minute ago, my second grandson was born. Emmett Larson was just born at 12:41 Central Time.
Wow.
Bravo, Bob.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Anyway, go on. Sorry to interrupt, but
everybody's okay? Or everybody's healthy?
Yeah, everybody's fine. I just took like 1 second to take the call because I thought that might be why he was calling. So continue on.
Wonderful.
All right. So where was I? My train of thought. Oh, I got introduced to C.S. Lewis and Mere Christianity. Little booklet. It's like a paperback that's probably no more than, I don't know, quarter of an inch thick. Not very much.
C.S. Lewis was quite the modern religionist.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what I understand, I don't know how much of this is accurate, but my understanding is that C.S. Lewis was... first of all, he started out as an atheist. He was a prominent professor at Oxford University in the last century, pre-World War II. He also had a radio show, if I'm not mistaken, of some type. But in any event, he was quite well known in the United Kingdom, or Great Britain in those days. And he was also, I believe, a great debater. So he prided himself in his logic ability to win debates. And I'll say a little about that in a minute. But he converted to Christianity by his own process of logic, which is quite a statement. And that process of logic is chronicled in the book Mere Christianity. That's what the book is about, in effect, how he came from total atheism to becoming a Christian. And I remember reading that book and reading it, and it was so impactful that I looked at that little book and I said, I'm not ready for this. If I accept everything that's in here, and I don't have right now a good argument against it, it will change my life so much that I would have to go and become a minister. I'd have to go to a seminary, because it won't just affect my daily life, you know, in terms of belief. It would be in everything I do. I'd have to become a preacher. And I said, I'm not ready for that. And I put it back on the shelf, and I said, you know, one of these days when I'm ready, I'll deal with this, but I'm not right now. That's the impact it had on me. The other thing I should tell you, for those of you who don't know anything about C.S. Lewis, is that I understand that later in life, C.S. Lewis did in fact lose a debate to one of his own students. And he was so devastated, according to the story that I heard, that he refused to teach anymore. And he devoted the rest of his life to writing children's stories, and that's how the Chronicles of Narnia were born, which was his way of trying to promote Christianity in disguised form for children. That's what the Chronicles of Narnia are all about, and that's where it comes from. So, the rest of it... I continued. There was a divorce. That set me back in terms of any headway I was gaining at United Church of Christ, and so my agnosticism continued for some time, and until by a very, very strange series of events, I happened to meet Crystalline about 17 years ago.
Wow, and, was it that long ago? That's hard to believe.
It was 95. Yeah. And the strange set of events culminated in a strange conversation Crystalline and I had, where I told her a much abbreviated version of what you've heard so far today. And her response was, so where are you now? And I said, I'm still searching. And she said, well, have you ever looked at the Urantia book? And the rest is history.
Really? So it was Crystalline that told you about the book originally?
Yeah. 17 years
cool.
ago.
Wow.
Yeah, he made a comment about that he had studied everything there was to study about religion. And he still was not quite certain what he could say he absolutely believed.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you've read everything there is to read about religion. He said, yeah, I've read everything I could find. And I said, well, have you read the Urantia book? He said, no. I said, well, I would recommend that be your next... I don't think you can say that you've read everything there is to read about religion until you've read that one.
Mm-hmm.
And that was about the introduction, wasn't it, Ron?
Well, you went a little further than that, because I asked you the obvious question, you know, who wrote it and, you know, that kind of stuff. And your response was something to the effect, I can get into this, that, and the other, but I would ask you to
you know, judge it on its merits. I think you'll find what you're looking for. And, you know, the rest of it is too long a story. And, you know, we're in a setting where I was not conducive to get into that. And frankly, what I did, I was the next day, I went to the tattered cover, as you may recall, our very, very famous bookstore in Cherry Creek. And the first thing I did when I found it was to look at the table of contents. And if memory serves me right, in the old edition, I mean, in the Foundation edition, it ran something like maybe 64 pages. I'm not exactly sure, but it was something of that order of magnitude. And I mean, I remember just reading the table of contents and going, "You got to be kidding me! I got to read this thing." So I grabbed it, and it took me a year to read it. And of course, now I know that I only, you know, captured maybe 0.1%.
Mm-hmm.
Especially listening to Chris Halverson, but I remember coming to the end of the book, and that was the night before, and on the way to the Flagstaff Conference.
Oh, really?
That's when I finished reading the book. Yeah, it was a marathon reading the last.
I was going to say you got through
it
very quickly.
I got to the conference. So, and very quickly, yeah. And I remember finishing it and saying, okay, the only thing I can tell you that I clearly stuck with me was the brotherhood of man and the fatherhood of God, or actually in the reverse order. And, boy, I don't know what to do with the rest of it. I mean, it certainly answered every question I could imagine. You know, life after death, why we're here, you know, blah, blah, blah. But I mean, in terms of where do I go with this forward, I just wasn't sure. But it certainly allayed my anxieties, fears about existence, curiosity. You know, it was, okay, I got it. If I need to know more, I know where to look.
One of the things that I find really comforting in the teachings in that book is that it really does synthesize pretty much all the different religious traditions of the world. It doesn't require for people to change their religion or to give up their religion.
Right.
It really offers people an opportunity to build upon the foundation of whatever their religious tradition is. And
as it should be.
There, you know, it does, like you said, Ron, it does sort of fill in all those gaps, answers all the questions that seem to be unanswerable by most traditional doctrine. And it does so with an air of authority and with a reasonableness. You know, it's logical and it's rational. And so it
speaks to... Well, that was the first thing I ever found that, yeah, was logical, rational, makes sense.
And spoke to the fairness issue that bothered your 7-year-old mind.
Right.
Oh, yeah. No question.
And, Mark, I don't want to cut you off either. We've only got a few minutes left. We wanted to give you an opportunity to say how you got involved in involved with the Urantia book relatively recently, right?
Well, for some unknown reason, my sister decided from seeing the Urantia book on a shelf somewhere and without knowing anything about it, decided that I would probably enjoy that book. So she went to the trouble of finding the book and giving it to me for a birthday, I believe, probably about 25 years ago. But my wife...
Okay, so it was quite a while back.
Well, but hang on. My wife was not interested. My wife and our two lives were so intertwined that there was just no way, even though I tried to interest her in it. We even went to the meeting in where was it, in Montreal about 17 years ago. We made a short appearance at that meeting, and she enjoyed being there, and we enjoyed the people, but there's just no way I could interest her in that book. So I kind of put it on the shelf, but when she passed away 5 years ago is when I pulled the book off the shelf and really jumped in with both feet.
Hmm. So it has been fairly recent.
Yeah, it is really basically fairly recent that I've really gotten involved and really taken it seriously.
So either one of you can answer this question if you would like, but how has the Urantia book influenced your sense of tradition and history with your Jewish culture?
Ron, you wanted to go first?
Well, mine is easy. I don't have a Jewish culture. So it had nothing, it had no impact there because I was a clean slate from that point of view. Like I said, it answered all of my questions, which started, when I was seven.
It didn't frighten you in the way that you were worried when it came to accepting C.S. Lewis's conclusions, that if you went in that direction, you were going to have to completely alter your life.
C.S. Lewis's conclusions were, again, what I would describe as, it's kind of like science of mind. It was deductive reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
C.S. Lewis basically said, if we, either Jesus is who he says he was, or he's a madman. I mean, that's the premise from which C.S. Lewis starts. So it's kind of and then he builds his, it's almost like a legal case. He's trying to say, well, is this logical? You'd be starting out with not part four, but parts one. To me, parts one, two, and three spoke more than part four. The eerie thing about part four is that when I started to read it, eerie for me because I, having lived in Israel for 13 years and identifying with the names and places and some of which I've been to, obviously, it was as though I was there. That was a totally different kind of reading. But by the time I got to part four, I already had my basic answers to my philosophical questions. Part four was like reading a novel.
Yes. What about you, Mark?
It's very difficult.
You had said you were a little bit apprehensive about getting to the Jesus papers because of your Jewish roots.
Right. And then when I finally did, and when I finally met the master, is when it all kind of came together for me and sort of confirmed for me the whole concept of progressive revelation. In other words, reading the Urantia book and accepting what I was reading in the Urantia book all of a sudden had me accept the New Testament as being an update for the Old Testament for the first time in my life, and only by virtue of the fact that I now had an update to not only the Old Testament and the New Testament, but to all of the world's religious doctrines. And there it was, right in front of me, and it's just an amazing experience to me to have this this book. I just got to get it in everyone's hands. It's just,
Yep.
It's just been a thrill a minute.
That's so good to hear, Mark.
Yep, I love it.
Well, thank you both, Ron and Mark, for calling in and sharing your personal experience with us. And I think we'll have to make an effort to get some more traditional Jewish perspectives and viewpoints on another show. I don't know if we've done much justice to that rich and historical faith, today, but I'm very grateful to both of you for calling in and sharing your experiences with us. Thank you both.
Oh, you're welcome.
You're welcome.
My pleasure. I got news for you. Jews are going to be Jews are going to be the hardest. It was not easy. And I got news for you. If I had gotten a book and put in my hand that had a picture of Jesus on it, it would probably have taken me all that much longer to open up that book. So,
we've certainly heard that opinion from many of our Jewish readers, and we do have many Jewish readers, and many of the most receptive early adopters of the Urantia book were our Jewish brothers and sisters. So, they made up a really large percentage of the early leadership of this movement. Go ahead.
What I was going to say is, I mean, to second what Mark said, I have a lot of Jewish friends, and I've heard the thing that struck me one time is the statement, quote, the Jesus thing, unquote.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, what is the Jesus thing? It was almost like that phrase had a special meaning to the Jewish people I know. The Jesus thing, it's like a stumbling block. I could not express what they were trying to say, but I got the very distinct impression that those three words were expressive of a very deep-seated feeling that I don't know how to describe. And that may be the issue.
Well, I think that there are probably many people who do experience that, a similar, reaction. Anyway, we're off the air now, but for any of the people who are listening to our audio show later in the week, they'll hear us conclude the show. But again, I'd really like to thank Mark and Ron for calling in, and I'd especially like to thank Andrea for helping co-host the program, and thanks for helping me read through that those religion papers, Andrea.
Mm-hmm. No problem.
And
no problem.
Next week, Andre Rodatis will be our co-host while Paula continues to be on vacation. And we will continue our interfaith discussion with other people who call in to share their personal religious experience. So we hope you'll join us again next week. And
love
from
you guys.
All of us here at Cosmic Citizen, thank you so much, and bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Bye for now. Love you guys.
Love you.
Bye-bye.
Love you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book, so all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.